against Lebanon last week to drive them to victory. A win will put Australia in an excellent position to qualify for the World Cup, with three of their last four games to be played at home. And briefly, Nathan Sharp will replace Will Genia as Wallabies captain for Saturday's clash with Argentina.
You're up to date with National Radio News.
The Pulse weather for Geelong and the Surf Coast, brought to you by the Victorian Regional Channels Authority. Keep clear of big ships.
The forecast for Geelong for today is for a maximum of 21 and sunny. And then tomorrow, a shower or two increasing, a minimum of 11, a maximum of 21. And going down to 14, 15 on Thursday and Friday with possible showers.
And now Barwon Water brings you the Barwon to Beach Surf and Water Report on 94.7 The Pulse.
Barwon water storage levels are currently at 95.9%, compared to 92% this time last year. Over the past week, there's been 37.4 millimetres of rainfall and 499 megalitres of water usage recorded in the region.
Now it's over to Zeb from Patagonia for the Surf Report.
Good morning, this is Zeb Walsh with the Patagonia Surf Report. There's still plenty of swell around from the weekend, waves in the 2 to 3 foot range, it's still nice and clean, straightening up a little bit. The wind's from the northwest this morning, but we'll be swinging to the northeast this afternoon, making Bells and Jack a good pick this morning, but 13th will be the go this arvo. High tide today was at 6.50 and 6.30pm, and the low tide will be at 12.10. Have a great day, guys, and make the most of the waves because summer's on its way.
Barwon Water, delivering quality services for our region. Visit barwonwater.vic.gov.au today.
Station sponsor.
The Blurb is brought to you by Great Escape Books in Aries Inlet. Make your escape with a coffee, gift or great read.
Yes, indeed. The Blurb is brought to you by Great Escape Books, and we haven't resurrected my theme because, well, I've been saving a really special theme for my fortnightly guest, John, who's with us here today. And I know he loves the Shostakovich so much that I can't find anything good enough to replace it with. Welcome, John.
Thanks a lot, Bernard. We'll have to find something to take the Shostakovich's place. Hard enough to say, let alone listen to.
I'm thinking of using Dave Brubeck's Take Five, but I thought that's a bit, I don't know what the word is, it's probably a very good English word, but you can't have Take Five for a two-hour program, can you?
Something with words or books in it, I think, we'll have to look for.
Have to think about that one. Nathan? Nathan's joining us too for reasons which I'm not going to go into because it's just all too embarrassing for me. However, yes, you're with The Blurb, and this is your weekly books program. And I know there are thousands of people, bibliophiles out there, who listen to the program every week, all over the world, in fact. Thousands of you out there, and it'd just be really good if either one of you rang in one day and told us you're listening, because we like to engage in a bit of discussion about books. And a special cheerio to the lady down in Drysdale, for whom my speech has been too quick, but I've been speaking very quickly since I was about 18 months old, I'm told, and it's probably a little bit late for me to slow down, but I will try a little bit today.
To speed it up a bit there.
Speed it up a bit. Now, while we're setting up our first interview, John, who are we going to be speaking to today?
We're going to be speaking to Candice Bruce today. And Candice is an art historian, a writer and a curator. Her first novel, The Longing, has just recently come out and has quite a connection with the Western District of Victoria. That's, I think, what sparked my interest in the beginning, and she's agreed to speak to us about it today.
Yes, and it's is it an historical novel? Both yes and no.
Actually, a dual narrative, which I'm sure you're looking forward to.
No, we've
had a present narrative and another narrative in the past.
How unusual!
It's your favourite type of narrative, I understand.
No, I don't. I like it, provided it's carried off with aplomb.
I think there's a bit of aplomb here between the pages.
Okay. Now, this is a very special song I'm playing today. This is. I have my favourite songs, as Nathan knows, because Nathan's very loyal. He's my most loyal listener, actually. Nathan's been listening to me every Tuesday for 2 years. But he will tell you that I have a few favourite songs. Now, this is one that I hadn't heard for a while, and a little bit of the backstory here. It's called, what's it called? Who knows Where the Time Goes? I've loved it for probably about 30 or 40 years. I didn't realise, I knew it had been recorded by Judy Collins, who will be singing it for you in a moment. Not personally, but She'll be singing it for you. What's happening? That's all right. It was written by Sandy Denny, who old-timers like me who are into folk music would recognise as the singer with, I think it's Fairport Convention, but someone might like to ring me up and correct me out there, but I didn't realise it was written by her. But I'm going to play that for you now. It's just a beautiful song by a beautiful voice. And, of course, those of us who went to Port Fairy this year heard Judy, and she's still remarkable in remarkable voice for a woman who's in her early 70s, so there could be a message there for some of us.
Across the morning sky, all the birds are leaving. Ah, how can they know it's time for them to go? Before the winter fire, we'll still be dreaming. I do not count the time. Who knows where the time goes? Who knows where?
Good afternoon, Candice.
Good afternoon, John.
Thank you very much for joining us on the program this afternoon.
That's a pleasure.
Now, let me just introduce you to our listening audience. You've been an art historian, a writer and a curator for many years, and you're actually the author of two books on the German-Australian romantic landscape painter Eugene von Gerard, and has quite a connection with us here in Geelong.
That's
and
right.
Your first novel, The Longing, has just been published. And just also for the listeners, let me just say that The Longing is about Ellis McCorrie, a young Scotswoman, her Aboriginal servant Louisa, and an American romantic landscape painter and collector, Sanford Pericles Hart. But there's also a second narrative too, a contemporary narrative, the story of a curatorial assistant, Cornelia Bremer, who's researching an exhibition on Hart for the National Gallery of Victoria. Now, as I said, there's a local connection for us here, the Von Gerard and Western District connection. I think here in Geelong we sort of look to the Western District as somehow belonging to Geelong, I don't know why. And we've also got at least one Von Gerard in the Geelong Gallery, I know, maybe more than one. You probably know better than I do.
Yes, it's a wonderful one. And it was only a fairly recent acquisition a few years ago that Geelong Art Gallery was able to get back from a private collector in England who had bought it. And it's one of his best paintings. It's a view looking right out to the new Geelong, which of course in 1855, when it was painted by Von Gerard, was very new town then.
That's the one from Ceres, I think, looking out.
Sorry, I can't hear you.
That's the one from Ceres, I think, looking out towards the Yu Yang.
No, I've lost you. Sorry, John, I can't hear anything.
Hello.
Hello. Hello.
Mm-hmm.
You
there?
Yes, that's better.
Sorry,
can you?
Some sort of technical.
No, you're.
Now we can hear each other.
No, I can't hear you again. I heard a hello, but that's it.
How are we doing now?
That's better.
Sorry about a little bit of a technical hitch at this end.
I was just talking
about the Von Gerard painting and asking if it was the one from Ceres looking towards the Yu Yangs. Is that the one?
Yes, that's one. Yes.
Now, I understand in 1979 you actually curated a retrospective exhibition of Von Gerard for the National Gallery of Victoria.
Yes, you're fading out again, but look, I'll keep talking. I got the tail end of that. I went around the Western District for a couple of weeks in 1979 preparing for the exhibition, looking at, I mean, as well as the paintings in public collections such as the Ballarat Art Gallery and I'm not quite sure, I can't remember whether Geelong had any works by Von Gerard then, maybe not.
No.
But mostly looking at private collections, of course, of which in those days, in the 70s still, there were still many Von Gerards in private collections throughout the Western District.
Yes. Now, I'd like to get the controversial stuff out of the way first. There is a bit of controversy around the story of The Longing in that you're telling a story, an Indigenous story, at least in part. Now, I identified with you because I'm trying to write a novel talking about the Nurrungeri around the Coorong in South Australia.
Yes.
I'm just wondering, I know you struggled a bit coming to terms with the fact of telling this story. How did you sort of come to terms with that in the end?
Yeah, look, it is a difficult thing because there is a perception in some areas of the community, in the Indigenous community particularly, that white writers should not go there, shouldn't try to speak with an Indigenous voice. But I consulted with people like Vicky Cousins, her father Ivan, who's a Gunditjmara elder, and my feeling was that it was to actually be able to present the story sympathetically and for the reader to really be able to empathise with the plight of my character Louisa, it was important to not write about her from one remove, you know.
It's
important to actually try to present her thoughts of what she and her experiences of what she really was going through as a survivor of a massacre.
Yes, yes. So it sounds like Vicky Cousins was quite an influence on your story.
Oh, she was. She was a tremendous help and we got along fantastically well. It was one of those synchronous moments that happened to, I'd already been working on the book for a couple of years, and I'd become very engrossed in the whole importance of possum skin cloaks to the Aborigines of Victoria, pardon me, and I'd completed quite a lot of research on possum skin cloaks and knew that that was going to be a central motive in the book.
Yes.
But then I happened to go to an exhibition of all places in Darwin and see one of Vicky's cloaks, and so we got in touch after that. I got in touch with her after that, and she in fact appeared with me at the Melbourne Writers Festival a week ago. We did a double act on stage.
Wonderful.
And so she was able to talk to the audience about her country, about the Western District and the importance of possum skin cloaks to the people both then and now, because they're going through this big revival, thanks largely to people like Vicky and her sister and
yes.
some Yorta Yorta women that she's worked with.
Yes.
And she, I guess, encouraged me to be brave enough to tackle it. And she, when in our conversation, she said, you know, because I said to her, I want to write with respect for Indigenous people. I want to write with accuracy. I want to show what really happened to the people.
Yes.
So both those things were incredibly important to stick to make sure that it was done in the spirit,
yes.
in a good spirit,
yes.
and that I didn't caricature anyone and stereotype
yes.
anyone. So she read the manuscript many times as it went through the various drafts.
So do you think we've sort of moved past that sort of quite sensitive time when, you know, it was really frowned on for a white writer to even attempt to tell, at least in part, an Indigenous story?
Yeah, look, we've gone in and out of it.
Mm.
If you look back to people like Sierra Astley, wrote black characters, Indigenous
yes.
characters, Catherine Susanna Pritchard. So it has happened in the past. Thomas Keneally, of course, with Jimmy Blacksmith. And then it seemed to, we went through this politically correct period, which has probably lasted up until now, although, you know, Alex Miller wrote Indigenous characters
right.
in Journey to the Stone Country, and
yes.
I don't know that he came in for much criticism for that.
No. And after all, I mean, we writers are really meant to be able to at least try to attempt to write in other voices, other than male or female, or...
That's right.
You know, that's part of the writing, isn't it?
It is. I see that as a big part of the role of fiction, is to try to take the reader into the head of the other.
Mm.
So in order to do that, you as the writer have to go there first.
That's right.
And lead the reader.
Yes.
And that's the challenge, to get the reader to... understand a character that might be so different to their own life experience.
That's right, yes. Now, I understand in the 1990s you're actually curating an Indigenous exhibition which did in the end fail. Can you say something about this?
Yeah, that was for Queensland Art Gallery, and that was going to be images by white artists of Indigenous people from all over the country. Because before I became a curator at Queensland Art Gallery, I'd worked on a very extensive research project called the Dictionary of Australian Artists, which tried to document every print, photograph, watercolour, oil painting in every public collection in Australia up to 1870. So if you're looking at a period of colonial settlement, there are many, many images, as you can imagine. What I realised as I researched it with a team of people, we realised that there was great state difference, geographic difference. You know, the way Aboriginal people are portrayed in WA, there are various ethnic differences anyway in the people and the way they dressed, but they were also, the people there were influenced by Portuguese sailors coming down the west coast from the Macassan Straits, which didn't happen down the east coast. And so, you know, so you have these significant differences in the portrayals. And so we accumulated a great list of images and, you know, very interesting things about corroborees and, you know, it's first contact. So
yes.
A lot of that information is only in the visual record often and not and is lost to maybe the written record or isn't covered in quite so much detail.
Yes.
But that really suffered from a view of political correctness and the fact that we were two white curators rating it. It fell on its sword when the Howard government came in. The funding for it was withdrawn, and after 5 years it just died.
Yes, that must have been a great disappointment to you.
Huge.
Yes, yeah.
It was very bitter, and it was, I guess, at that moment that I thought, I've got to do something else. I can't
do this
sort of thing anymore. And I'd always wanted to write fiction.
Mm.
And I had a husband then who, well, he's still in my life now, I'm happy to say, who said, oh, crying out loud, would you write that
book? Just do it. Now, look, another quite controversial aspect is your reference to massacres of Indigenous people. Now, I understand that the massacre in your story is based on actual historical massacre, the Murdering Gully massacre of 1839 in Camperdown.
That's right.
Apart from sort of, you know, bringing these stories out to the public, what do you think is the next step after that?
Well, with that, I was very careful to change the names. I didn't use any actual geographic names, and so people from the Western District who know the geography will probably be a bit perplexed when they read some of my book, because I've thrown in a lot of fictional landmarks along with real landmarks, and that was done deliberately to stop any kind of offence that might happen to descendants of those massacres.
Yes,
and to show a sensitivity, I guess, about that material. But I relied a lot on both the historical records of Victoria, which of course are published and can be bought through the government printing office, and they contain, a lot of your listeners would be aware of Jan Critchett's two wonderful books on the Western District, and Ian Clark's work on massacre sites. Now, you don't have to go very far to know that it happened all over the Western District, or it happened all over Victoria, but the Western District, I think, was especially hard hit because of its, I have this theory, I don't know if it's true, because of its very open geography, that it was very hard for the people to escape.
Yes.
And whereas if you look at white settlement, colonial settlement in Gippsland at the same time, because the Kurnai could hide in very mountainous, heavily forested areas around Gippsland, they could kind of have attacks on the colonial settlers and then retreat back into the mountains.
Mm-hmm.
It was much, much harder for Aboriginal people to do that in the Western District, and I think they suffered as a result.
Now, we must come to terms with these historical facts, but what do you think is the next step after coming to terms with them?
Well, I think the thing that I've learned from my contact with Vicky is that, and I wanted to make this very much a strong point in the book, is that Aboriginal people from the Western District have survived. They've not only survived, they've thrived. There's still, many of them are still in touch with their culture and traditional ways. There's a big revival of language through people like James Dawson's book has been used in the dictionary of Gunditjmara, Kirirarong languages. And she struck me the first time I met her with this, her grace and the fact that she's not an angry person, she's not bitter, she is having a wonderful life. She is, you know, creative artist doing her cloaks and her artwork and her film and all sorts of various things and involved. I mean, I don't know how she does it with five children and keeping up. So there's, I think there's tremendous way to go to say, well, there's a wonderful reason to celebrate as
yes,
well.
Yes.
And not for it to be, to acknowledge the history, to acknowledge that it